Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Dr. Darrell Ray is our speaker today, and if you don't know who he is, I don't know how that's possible, but anyway, he is the founder and president of the board of directors of Recovering from Religion. He has been a speaker in RFRX before. I think he has been three times already, maybe four. I don't know. I lost count already. But anyway, he has been a psychologist for over 30 years, and he's the author of four books. Two of them are about organizational teamwork. And then we have one of them that's called The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, and another one that's called Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. And today we're going to speak about religious trauma, its roots and its treatments. So Dr. Ray, thank you so much for being here and welcome.
Thank you, Maya. I just want to back up here. Maybe we could change the program tonight. I'd like to learn more about sunshine in your butthole therapy. I can't stop laughing in my head about that. I'm not sure I can complete this talk without thinking about that.
Well, so why don't I pull up some pictures and we can...
Yeah, don't.
I got my vacation to Cancun all lined up here, and I'll just show you exactly how it works.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for that great introduction, Maya. And good to be here with everybody, and to talk about a subject we all obviously are pretty concerned about, and something near and dear to my heart. And I will just say that this has. I want to give a word of caution here. I try not to use any triggering language or examples, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and that you might not have some experience, negative experience from just examples or some of the things I say. So I want you to feel free to leave if you feel the need to turn off the sound. You know, take care of yourself. That's number one for RFR. We are concerned about you. At the same time, we're trying to educate people and try to help you understand what you may have experienced or what your loved ones or friends or other people in your life may have experienced through religious indoctrination, and perhaps give some ideas of how it can be treated. So that caution.
That's kind of it comes to the question of like, I know what religious is. I know what trauma is. I kind of can assume what those two words together mean, but what would be a good starting point of like helping us leap off of what understanding what religious trauma is? Like, is this something you found in the DSM? Is this something that's diagnosable?
You are about, 4 slides ahead of me there.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I tell you what, fine. I'm going to go sun my butthole, and you can just carry on with your slideshow.
No, that's a good question. And that's really, it really does need to be defined. We need to kind of come to terms with what it is. And in order to do that, I need to share my screen here. I want to give you guys some... visuals to enjoy and watch. Okay. So what is trauma? I'm not going to talk about what religious trauma is, because we need to get more basic and say, what is trauma? And I think that was part of your question. What is trauma? What is religion? We've got those two pieces here. So what is trauma? And it's actually pretty simple. It's a change in the brain. That's all it is. Trauma is a change in the brain. We can see it as a result of stress hormones, change in the way the amygdala is working in the brain. We can look at the fight center of the brain and realize that something's going on there. And if it's, we can look at other things like the adrenal cortical gland on the top of the kidneys, and actually see that particular gland can be actually grows. You know, if I exercise my muscles will grow. Well, if you're constantly exercising your fight, flight, fear response, your adrenal gland is producing adrenaline. And there's studies going back 50 years that show that constant stimulation of fear or anger or fight flight or any of those kind of things dumps more hormones into your system, adrenaline for this in this case, and your adrenal gland becomes bigger. Well, that means it's producing more and it's constantly dumping it into your system. So when I say it's a change in the brain, I shouldn't limit it to the brain, because there's other organs in your body that are also affected by the stress of trauma. So it's a generalized response of your body and your brain to the stress that you're feeling in your environment. Now I'm going to kind of go into the symptoms or things you might experience if you experience trauma. And this is trauma, not religious trauma, just trauma. And it's, you know, you can go to Iraq as a soldier and experience trauma that has nothing to do with religion. Or you could have other kinds of trauma that weren't related to religion. But hypervigilance is one of the key components of trauma. And you've heard this from, clearly going back to World War I, soldiers come back from the war or World War II or Vietnam, and they hear a loud sound and they hit the deck just as if they were in a foxhole or if they're on a ship trying to avoid explosions, even though it was just a firecracker or a car backfiring or nothing more than that. So a person who's experienced trauma is hypervigilant. Their brain is wired to respond to their environment in ways that are not normal. I mean, I might jump if I hear a car backfire, but I'm probably not going to hit the deck. I'm probably not going to break my bones to get in a hole, and that sort of stuff. I'm also not going to be easily stimulated by things that nobody else is responding to in my environment. So it's our brains are wired to interpret danger in otherwise normal circumstances. So I would see danger where you don't if I had experienced trauma. So you're on a hair trigger. Your emotions, your internal responses are always on a hair trigger. And for those of us who have not experienced true trauma, we probably don't understand how difficult this is. I mean, think about it. If going through life, if some what appears to be to most people a small thing sets you off and you can't control it, or it's out of control before you even know it, then it's just not understandable by people who have not experienced that piece. Now, moving towards religion, I've been out of religion for years, but there's still something, and I would not say, I'm not saying that I've been traumatized or were traumatized, but I still have reactions to religious things in my environment. I left religion years and years ago, and yet there's still things that can, piss me off. a big billboard that says, are you going to hell? Or Jesus loves you and he's going to send you to hell. I don't know. You know, that's the kind of thing you see up on billboards. And that I'm not traumatized by it. I'm not. It doesn't ruin my day. But I know people that it would ruin their day. It's got such a power over them, even if they've been out of religion for a long time. So other things you might experience if you have been traumatized by religion is things like intrusive thoughts about demons, about hell. I mean, if we've got a lot of volunteers on here, I bet we've got at least a half a dozen volunteers here tonight. And if I called on any of them to tell me a story they've seen on the chat line or on our phone calls, every one of them would be able to probably give multiple stories about people they've chatted with or talked to that had night terrors, that wake up with nightmares around demons or hell. And in some cases, these people have been out of religion for years. So it's your brain. Your brain is literally rewired if you have been traumatized. Serious sleep disturbances can be a big part of that, as well as, and I mentioned earlier, nightmares. And in our questions we asked earlier, it looked to me like certainly half of everybody who took the survey has experienced one or more of those items that I listed in the questions. Another thing is that what I call cognitive loops or cognitive traps, and that is I can't stop thinking I might be wrong. I can't stop thinking I might be going to hell. I can't stop thinking maybe Jesus was right. You know, it's cognitive loops. And as we know, at Recovering from Religion, logic does not get you out of those cognitive loops. Just talk to any of our volunteers, and you'll find that the more you use logic in the traditional sense, the less progress you can make with somebody. Now, we have ways of helping them, don't get me wrong, but your next door neighbor can't logic you out of your fear of hell. It just can't happen because they don't have the skills. And finally, in this list is depression. We see a lot of depression around religious trauma. And what is really interesting is people can experience, and I mean a significant number of people who are still in religion are experiencing depression. They don't know. They're being told, well, you need to pray harder. You need to go to church more. You need to read your Bible more, or you know, whatever the ritual is for their, you know, go to mosque and pray harder on Fridays or whatever. They don't realize that the source of that depression is the religion itself, because the religion itself has got all sorts of messages about what a horrible person you are, and you're worthless, and you can't do anything without God, and anything you do, you must thank God for, even if it was you doing all the work. So all these things come in to comprise what can be religious trauma. Now, I am not here to diagnose you, and I'm not here to tell you how to diagnose yourself. Our friend Gail is a lawyer, and she will back me up on this one. That old saying, a lawyer who defends himself as a fool for a client. Well, that's true of self-diagnosis. Even a good psychologist shouldn't be diagnosing themselves. So don't go out of here saying, well, Daryl said something. I think I'm a religious trauma victim. No, go to a therapist and find out. I'm not even worried about your diagnosis. I'm more worried about your life happiness and dealing with some of the issues that religion may have caused you. So the Centers for Disease Control years ago, not too many years, within the last 10 years, came out with a really interesting survey. It's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey. And it's a very, very simple, I think 12 questions is all it has. And it just asks some questions around childhood experiences. And what the CDC found, and it's been cross-referenced with lots and lots of other studies over the years, is children that are subjected to certain experiences in childhood don't get over those experiences. They take that experience as a trauma, or imbibe it as a trauma, and take it into adulthood. And as a result, we have adults running around, lots of adults running around, with childhood trauma. And the statistics I've seen are as high as 20% of just the average Joe or Jane on the street has experienced childhood trauma, and is still carrying the effects of that today in their adult behavior. So you can go online and just Google adult adverse childhood experiences CDC, and you'll get this. Take it yourself. This will help you point in the direction of trauma. If you score high enough, the CDC survey will say you probably are experiencing trauma. Now, I'm not religious trauma. That's not what we're talking about yet. You're experiencing trauma of some kind related to your childhood. So it's a worthwhile thing to do, because it'll help you realize, okay, I'm only scoring a 3. Any issues I'm having, I can probably handle, or I can talk to my mother, or I can talk to my, you know, my best friend about. But if you're scoring up there in a 5 or 6 or 7, yeah, it's probably something you need to find a therapist for. And that's part of the reason the CDC created this survey. Now, in the survey the CDC did, there is no mention whatsoever of religion. Not one question deals with religion. I'm not going to say that's my criticism of the survey, because that wasn't the purpose of the survey. And so I'm not going to criticize that piece of it. I am saying, though, that we need to acknowledge that the reason a kid experienced trauma as a child, I mean, you were beaten every day, you're spanked every day as a child. The CDC does not ask, were you spanked because your father was a fucking narcissist, or were you spanked because your mother was a religious nutcase? I mean, well, it's something like that. if you go to the roots of that, you'll realize that you could have childhood religious experiences, adverse childhood religious experiences that are directly related to your mother's, your father's, your aunt's, your family's fundamentalist beliefs about how to discipline a child. And the CDC does not even look at that. There's not a hint that that could be a part of the reason why children have abuse and trauma. So that's partly why we're here to talk today, because I want to raise awareness of what's going on here. I want to raise awareness in people who may have been traumatized. Or I want you to look around and realize maybe some of your friends have experienced religious trauma and they don't even know it. They may still be in the religion. And to ask them, well, were you traumatized by your religion, makes no sense whatsoever. You cannot tell, and I'll almost make this a categorical statement, you cannot tell a religious person that their religion is the cause of their psychological problems, because their religion teaches the opposite. Jesus loves you. Jesus is going to heal you. Pray harder. If you're depressed, it's your own damn fault. You need to pray to Jesus more. You need to come to churches more. So by definition, religion cannot cause mental health problems, according to them, of course. We know better. The reason I say that to you is I don't want you to go out and start talking to your family members about their depression and then telling them, well, it's probably because your religion is causing your depression. You're not going to get very far with that one. So there's actually a neurological impact that we can see in any person who's experienced trauma. And that takes the subjectivity out of it quite a bit. I'm not saying the diagnosis or diagnosing trauma isn't still subjective, but there are literally ways to identify in behaviors and in biology and in neurology that you are responding to some kind of trauma. And that we can look at the changes in the limbic system's functioning. We can see that things like the hypothalamic and pituitary and adrenal axis is going crazy, and the cortisol levels are varying quite dramatically. I mean, none of those things are within the range of normal. So, I mean, we know that the body is going to have, I mean, just to take one thing, estrogen or testosterone, we know there's a range of normal for that. And if you get outside of that, it may be indication of some kind of disease condition. Doesn't guarantee it, but it's a diagnostic criteria. The same can be said here. You look at somebody's adrenal gland and see it's three times bigger than it should be. You might want to make a guess about that. What's causing that stress? What's causing that adrenal gland to produce so much extra adrenaline and other hormones? Adrenal gland doesn't just produce adrenaline. You can see neurotransmitters in the brain that are out of balance. And that's where depression comes from within religion, because religion causes a lot of neurotransmitter disruption in the brain, which leads to depression. And then people who are religious try to pray their way out of it. They can't get out of it. So they go, and then their religion says, don't go to a psychiatrist, don't take drugs. Well, then you're just going to get worse. Well, then they'll go to, let's say they do go to psychiatrists and they do take the drugs and it does help them. Well, then they're kind of going against their religion maybe. But they never identify that it's the religion itself that is causing this depression. Some people are more susceptible to environmental suggestions than other people are. If you're in a religion that tells you you're a piece of shit and that you're worthless and you're going to hell and nobody but Jesus loves you, for some people, that's going to get into their head and it's going to cause problems. If they imbibe that and they become depressed, they're probably not going to say, well, it was my religion that caused that. So that's kind of the problem we're up against in talking about religious trauma. But there is some good news here, and I don't want to be a total downer here. And that is, if a child has stuff in their environment that allows them to be more resilient, that kind of protects them, helps them to be, remove themselves from the environment, perhaps. For example, in my case, I came from a pretty religious family, but I had an aunt and uncle that were extremely liberal. They were still religious, but they were very liberal. And I could go over to their house and talk to them about stuff I could never talk to my parents about. In fact, my parents weren't too happy that I did that. So it got me out of the environment. If you can remove the child from the environment, you know, maybe you're in a fundamentalist area and you move, your family moves to another area and you're amongst people who are not fundamentalists, that might be a resilience factor. And also resources. I met a number of people that said, when I was a kid, I was able to escape my family by going to the city library. And I would spend as much time as I could get away with in the city library because I wouldn't be surrounded by religion. So that's a resilience factor as well. And it's some resources that child is able to draw upon. I loved going to the library because I could check out books by nobody wanted me to check out, like on sex, for example, which might surprise you all. So therapists, about a year ago, we asked as many therapists as we could get a hold of within the Secular Therapy Project. We asked them this question: is, in your professional experience, what percent of clients mention adverse childhood experiences related to religion in some significant way? For example, spanking for not learning their Bible verses, or punishment for masturbating, or abusing a sibling because they were gay, or whatever. Threats of hell, all, some of the stuff I took in the survey or put out in the survey. And from that, we found that 36% of our therapists reported this. Now, remember, these therapists are taking clients from all sources. These aren't just clients that are coming from the Secular Therapy Project. Any given therapist might get 2 or 3 referrals a year from Secular Therapy Project, but get 50 referrals from all other places, like group homes or churches or judges. So there's a lot of other places. So 36% of the people coming to them for help were mentioning adverse childhood experiences directly related to religion, which I think is a pretty interesting thing. If you look around you today, is it possible that 30% of the people in your neighborhood are experiencing some kind of adverse experience from their childhood rearing and religion? I think it's entirely possible. I want you to do a little thought experiment right now. Imagine you're a 6-year-old child in a house, and you are the source of your fear, the source of the shaming, the source of the threatening is all coming from your parents. As a 6-year-old, you have no place to hide. You can't go in your room because they'll barge in. They're going to control your time and tell you what you can and can't do. There's no safe space for a child in one of those kinds of environments. Now, even if this environment is not, incredibly physically abusive, it still is psychologically abusive because this poor child is being constantly supervised, overseen, spied upon, told what they can and can't do. They are literally not able to develop normal childhood ideas and interests. And as a result, a long enough exposure to that, maybe 1 year isn't long enough, but what if it was 3 or 4 or 5 or your whole childhood? Sooner or later, it's going to tip the balance into trauma. And that's why even a family that's not super fundamentalist religious can still, over a period of time, just like a steady drip, 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 you eventually the balance goes to the other side and some piece of it becomes traumatic. So the constant issue with a child is they're constantly having to monitor themselves and for fear of their religious consequences. And Eric, I don't see the survey, but that was one of the questions in the survey. What was the numbers on that one?
Dr. Ray, you want me to bring up the survey?
Yeah, just put it up there.
All right.
I'm going to
go ahead and share the results. With the first question, have you ever had religiously related nightmares? We had 46% say yes, 30% say no, and oddly enough, 24%. That's a pretty high percentage, I think. Aren't sure about that. The second question, did you miss developmental opportunities due to religious restrictions? And 69% said yes.
Wow.
23% said no, and only 8% weren't sure about that. Question three, was the threat of hell ever used to control your behavior? And as we probably suspect, 77% of the audience here had that threat of hell held over them. 16% no, and 8% wasn't sure. And then were you severely disciplined for not following your religious doctrine? And it was kind of split between yes or no, 42% yeah. and 41% respectively, with 17% not sure.
So we can say that three quarters of the people listening right now in this Zoom room have experienced one or more of these issues. And that's pretty large.
Yeah.
And probably means that there's some consequence to you right now. Now, just because you said this was true of your childhood does not mean you were traumatized. I want to be real clear about that. You could have had a hellacious childhood, but you had resilience factors that allowed you to get out of it reasonably well with not major consequences. So we always have to be careful not to say, well, because of this, that, because that's just not the way psychology or humans actually work. So what happens here is that people miss developmental stages. Now, when you miss a developmental stage, that's a major problem. And we've seen this in animal studies for decades. When you create a situation in which an animal cannot move normally through a developmental stage, there's almost always consequences in adulthood. I think a lot of the studies have been done around birds or pigs and monkeys or other primates, and what they find is it oftentimes disrupts their mating pattern, so they literally don't ever develop the skills they need to mate properly. And I'm sure it's true of humans too. And that's just one area, of course, but people miss developmental opportunities as a result of being so overwhelmed with religious ideology and behavior during the adolescent and pre-adolescent childhood years. People often tell me I missed my whole childhood because I was so afraid. Or I missed my adolescence because I was always in church and afraid of my body. I was scared to death to masturbate. And whenever I did, it would cause me great nightmares or you know, something like that. Excuse me. So you can see if you're constantly experiencing these kinds of things, the normal things that a child and an adolescent should be going through are skipped or never experienced. And I don't know about you, but I've seen so many people, and I think our volunteers would agree with this, tell me that when I finally got out of religion, I went wild. I went out and started playing around. I've had a different date every night. And, you know, I started spending money I shouldn't have been spending, or I started drinking, or I drank coffee. Oh, I had a Mormon tell me he started drinking coffee. Forbid. Yeah, so people, they're almost like decompressing. They're exploding. And what you see if you examine this behavior, in which I have as a therapist, you'll see that, yeah, they're going out and behaving in a way that we would call irresponsible or out of control. I mean, people use those terminology. What I would say is they're trying to experience a developmental stage that they missed. And instead of experiencing over a lifetime of childhood, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15 years of childhood or more, under competent adult supervision, so they, you know, they had some governing things because their brains weren't mature enough to govern themselves. Now they're 25 years old or 50 years old and trying to experience that, and they don't know where to go. And they can feel lost. They can feel I've had people say, I feel like a ship without a rudder and the wind's blowing from every direction. I mean, I don't know if you've ever experienced those kinds of things. That's probably a sign of developmental losses. You didn't experience the developmental stage you needed. So what we see in therapists, and this is, I want a little side here, is that therapists are not aware of this whole idea. I met a therapist that I consider pretty well trained the other day, about 2 weeks ago. And we got to talk, and she found out I was a retired psychologist. And I said, well, are you familiar with the concept of religious trauma syndrome? And she had never heard of it, number one. And she said, that doesn't even compute. I don't know how religion can cause trauma. Now, this is a person who's probably seen hundreds of clients in her career already. And she doesn't know that religion could cause some of the trauma that I am positive she had in her practice, just from the survey we did with our own. So therapists are not trained to understand this or see this. Now, I want to go the other side. I just had, some of you know, I run a camp on my property, and I had a therapist come camp here, and I was asking her about her graduate school training right here in Kansas City at University of Kansas City, Missouri. And she said, we had an entire study group in my graduate school that studied and wrote papers on religious trauma. I thought, hallelujah. We got people at the graduate school level starting to understand how religion impacts people's lives, brains, and developmental stages. So I'm thrilled about that. And just that was kind of the opposite of what I'd heard from this other one. But, you know, the other therapist had actually, you know, been in practice for decades. And so her training was quite old compared to the one that just graduated in the last few years. So we're trying to raise, as Secular Therapy Projects, we're trying to raise awareness for what this can do to people and how to treat it. Now, back to kind of our main focus here is, what if 60% of our population here in North America was infected with tapeworms? We could say, under some definition, that it's normal to be infected with tapeworms. I hope you're not, by the way. I would not want to be infected with a tapeworm. But we would also agree that being infected with a tapeworm is debilitating, that it drains energy from you, reduces your immune system. It does a lot of bad things to your body. So we don't go out there and try to get infected with tapeworms. I mean, some people are going out trying to get infected with COVID, which makes no sense to me. But we wouldn't say it's a desirable thing, and yet it's normal. Can you see the difference? Something could be normal but not desirable. Well, religion does the same thing. Religion is a tapeworm of the mind. It gets in your brain, takes over your critical thinking skills. You can clearly see how stupid everybody else's religion is, but not your religion. We've had a chatter the last two or three days. Three of our chatline agents have talked to him by phone. I guess he called in, and he is calling in to try and we don't bite on his what he's trying to sell us. He's trying to tell us that Lutheranism is the right religion. So he can criticize Mormonism and Islam. He can criticize all the other religions, but he can't use the same logic on his own religion. It's great evidence that religions are a parasitic mental virus, takes over your mind, takes over certain aspects of your thinking process to protect itself. And that's what religion does. It also takes 10% of your money and gets you to waste a whole lot of time doing whatever the religion says you have to do. So I'm going to suggest religion is like a tapeworm of the mind. Religion is debilitating because it's not a model for reality. And one of our clients said this. I just stole it. I just thought it was classic. He said, it's so easy to lose touch with reality when you're not dealing with reality in the first place. So you can see, if you are used to being told crazy, stupid stuff and being forced to believe it, how easy it would be for you to believe other crazy, stupid stuff. And I'm not kidding you. I've seen people who finally figured it out, that they're, you know, no longer religious. They figured out what their religion was all about, but they go right out and they're just as susceptible to the next crazy idea that comes along. It's like their brain's immune system has been beaten down so badly they can't think critically about almost anything, which makes the entire world very confusing to this person. And some people, once they get out of religion, they look around, they don't have the skills, it's very confusing, they go back to religion. We see that occasionally. It's the rum, I call that the Rumspringa effect. I don't know if you're familiar with the Rumspringa and the Amish. At about 15 or 16 years of age, the Amish tell their children, yeah, you can go out, spend a whole year out there and sow your wild oats, do whatever you want to do, and then decide whether you want to come back here or not. If you come back here, you're never leaving again. And if you go away, you'll never see us again because we won't talk to you. You're isolated or disfellowshipped. So it's Rumspringa. And what you see in these kids is they get out in the real world. Well, living on a farm, raising pole barns with an eighth grade education doesn't exactly prepare you for modern day living in the world. So they go out there at 16 years of age, and the whole world is just bewildering to them. They can't function. They don't have the skills. They don't have the knowledge. And they come back and they spend the rest of their lives in the Amish religion. Well, that's what, it's not just the Amish that do that. Think about the homeschooling Baptist mother. No aspersions to Gail Jordan, but if you isolate those children enough and they have no skills when they get out of the home, they're going to go out. And if they do, if they don't survive, they don't do well, they're going to come back to religion. So it's a great trick that religion uses to teach you stuff that's non-functional. Then when you go out in the real world and you can't function, then you realize, oh, Jesus must be the answer, and you come back. Or it could be Allah's the answer, or it could Joseph Smith the answer. I don't know. Whatever religion it is, the techniques are all the same. So a friend of mine, Dr. Juanine Manel, which I think a number of you have read her book on leaving the fold, and she's the person who coined the term religious trauma syndrome. And she and some other folks, Janice Selby, who's been a speaker here two or three times now, were organizing, with our help, organizing a whole conference on religious trauma syndrome, but it got canceled because of COVID. But what Dr. Winnell says is, in general, people who have not survived authoritarian fundamentalist indoctrination do not realize what a complete mind rape it really is. And I think that's a good way to say it. It's a mind rape. It's and to go back to what we said earlier, it's a reprogramming of your mind. It's a changing of the biochemicals and the neurological components of your brain. And so it really does screw with your mind, screw with your body. Here's a quote that came right out of our own community. Basically, my family were and still are very end times oriented. My whole childhood was filled with daily fear that I had missed the rapture, like literally every single day. It was all I could think about. I asked for help from my family and other church members, and they basically told me to pray and trust God, which didn't help me at all. I'm at the point where I no longer logically believe any of this, but the fear that I have is instinctual. Now, that's their word, instinctual. I wouldn't use that word myself. I would call it brainwashed or indoctrinated or something like that. It completely bypasses my rational mind and puts me in a state of panic. I'm 30 years old, and I wish I could just live and be free from fear. Direct quote right from our own community. This, if I was working with this person, everything they just told me right there screams religious trauma syndrome. But I'm not here. I would do a lot more than just read something to diagnose it. But that sounds pretty much like what somebody would describe if they had experienced religious trauma. Dr. Winnell again says sanitizing religion makes it all the more insidious when it's toxic. For example, small children are biologically dependent on their adult caretakers. And built into the survival mechanisms is the need to trust authority just to stay alive. Religious teachings take hold easily in their undeveloped brains, while the adults conveniently keep control. This continues generation after generation as the religious meme complex reproduces itself and masses of believers learn to value self-loathing and fear the apocalypse. And she uses the term meme complex. If you read my book, The God Virus, I basically say the same thing, only I don't use the word meme or memeplex. But other people have said the same thing. She and I aren't the inventors of this concept. But what we can say is that we're the ones, all of us in RFR and Dr. Winnell at Journey Free are all very committed to trying to show how religion's getting a pass in our environment. Not only do they not pay taxes, but they cause tons of social problems under the guise of being a charitable organization. How many people are experiencing serious depression as a direct result of the horrible training they got in their religion. I can only guess that it's in significant amounts of people. Having grown up in church and seen all the people that I now know were probably depressed, there's a bunch of them in there. Maybe 10 to 20% of the people in any church I've ever been in could probably be diagnosed as clinically depressed. So another client said, I had panic attacks Saturday when I stepped foot in a church for the first time in nearly 9 years. I thought I could handle it. I know that seems weird, but the level of indoctrination is deep. Another client said, those pervasive beliefs are like a dormant virus. I never know when they're going to activate. Well, if you know anything about the measles virus, if you ever had the measles, you still have the measles today. The virus is still in your system, and it can come out later as shingles. That's why it's important to get the shingles vaccine, because it can reappear at any time. Well, the God virus is kind of the same way. You know, when somebody gets infected with a religion, they may get rid of it, but then their mother comes down with cancer, or they get in a major car wreck. Some stressful thing happens to them, and you often see people going back to religion because that's where that source of indoctrination was. This client said, it's left me hating men in church and then struggling with men outside of it. All I seem to have experienced is wilderness or weirdness or abuse. Everyone seems so scared all the time. Now, from within this person's mind, everyone else seems so scared. But I'll bet if we were looking at this person, we would say she's probably got some religious trauma going on there. She may have experienced religious or sexual abuse within the church. You know, we all see that coming all the time. So other things is sleep deprivation, fear, isolation from family. All these things can happen, and they cause more and more trauma. I'm started wonder if all the damage that in this case, this is a client that chatted in with us, and they were talking about they had become fundamentalist and then came back to try and convert their family. So that's what we're reading here. Somebody who themselves became quite radical. So I'm starting to wonder if all the damage of me believing in God and the Bible is traumatized my family because they lost me. And they did. I lost me too, she said. I became so scared and religious, so scared of hell. I was just depressed and obsessed with saving my family that I lost all normal connection with them. I don't sleep properly most nights, and now I'm scared of what I've done to my mom. So not only is she probably traumatized herself by going into this religion, but she may have traumatized her family too. RTSs can be created by religious activities, and the religious activities can be as simple as going into your minister for counseling. What if your minister goes in and you, trusting your minister, tell him or her that, you know, I masturbate once in a while. And what if the minister comes back and said, well, you know, you're going to hell for that, or berates you, or worse yet, tells your parents, or worse yet, does something like exposes you to the rest of the congregation? I've seen all of those things happen. Worse yet, and probably the worst, a young couple who was not married were feeling really guilty. This is a woman I knew about 10 years ago, feeling very guilty. So they went to their minister to confess their sin of having had sex, the two of them. Now, these were normal, you know, 18, 19-year-old people, and they were going to go confess their sexual sin to the minister. The result of that was the minister announced that, without telling them, they did not know this was going to happen. The next Sunday, the minister announced that, you know, Jane and Joe were going to come up and confess their sins, and they forced the woman to go up first and tell the whole congregation in some detail, I guess, shame the hell out of her. And then they named the boy, but didn't make him come up. I mean, this person suffered for years as a result of that treatment. And this is because we trust the minister to maintain confidentiality, and he did not do that. The advice he gave probably was pretty crazy too. So there's lots of activities within religion that can then make people experience trauma or can put trauma in the way of your life. And Christian counseling is one of the worst. I mean, there's so many Christian counselors out there, and they are doing so much damage. You're actually paying somebody to damage you. And that's about the way Christian counseling works. Homeschooling can do it. Academic restriction. I mean, think about the kid who goes to through high school, through homeschool, and never learns basic ideas and has no opportunity to socialize with anybody except his religious group. All of these things can force you to skip developmental stages, and it may cause religious trauma of some kind. Conversion therapy. I think, Amaya, you guys are going to have a program on a conversion therapy in the near future. So I'm not going to spend any time with that, but the pray the gay away kind of stuff. Amaya has really done a good job of finding great speakers for this series, and that's one I'm going to look forward to. Movies and media. I cannot tell you how many times we see right in our own chat line people telling us, I was traumatized by the Left Behind series, or I was forced to watch that Thief in the Night movie, and I couldn't sleep for weeks. These kinds of media events with everybody else in your youth group sitting around watching them together and then talking about them later and then going and trying to sleep at church camp after seeing those two things are almost designed to create trauma. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm not trying to be dramatic here. I've just seen it too many times. And I'm going to throw that out. Baby Gail, briefly, have you seen, you remember seeing some of these chats, have you not?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Such a huge impact because of the fear that's still so ever present right below the surface.
Yeah. It's crazy. Jesus Camp. If you've never watched that video, you should watch it. Unless it triggers you, don't do that. it's pretty crazy. Quote, leadership training. I've seen too many church leadership training things, and they're not leadership training. They're brainwashing trainings, what they are. Fear of hell. We hear that all the time. I'm not going to go into that anymore. This client told us it's infuriating to see how religion victimizes people who already have enough challenges. It's kind of like a virus that doesn't give a shit if it damages or kills you as long as it gets passed along to the next victim. I read that somewhere. LOL. This was a person who obviously read my book and was trying to be funny to me, which I laughed a lot about that. I want to talk about the distinction, though, between distortion and trauma as we start learning about how to treat. You can have cognitive distortions or ideas that don't match with reality, but that does not mean you have been traumatized. So I am going to suggest that everybody listening to my voice right now probably has some ideas that do not match with reality that came straight out of religion. Even if you've been an atheist, even if you're not religious, even if you went to a liberal church or something, there's still things that you may believe. I mean, I have a lot of I'm not going to go into it here, but I've got so many atheists telling me, yeah, there's such thing as sex addiction. Well, go watch my video on the myth of sex addiction. Why would somebody still believe what is basically a religious idea? Also, I have people who believe that you got to go through a 12-step program in order to get out of drug addiction. No, that's a religious idea. 8 of the 12 steps all deal with God. AA is a religion. It is not a treatment program. So there are secular people who still believe religious ideas. And it takes a while for us to challenge some of those. And a lot of the things people still believe are the shame and the guilt around all sorts of things. Their body. I hear a lot of self-shaming around my own body. And I try to tell people, it's the only body you got. It's the only life you got. Make the best of it. The more you shame yourself, the less you're going to actually enjoy your body. And your body's made to have fun and made to enjoy. There's lots of positive things about having a healthy body and enjoying your body. But religion told us the exact opposite, that your body is your enemy. And I've met many a secular person who still has some level of belief around that. This person here in this quote says, I spent years trying to get over my body shame. I read the books, but it makes no difference. It affects my ability to find a partner. So when I read that, I think, oh, they skipped a developmental stage. They did not learn how to properly develop sexual relationships with another person at the right time. And now they're trying to make up for that. And to some degree, it looks like unsuccessfully. So most people probably have some distortion, but they don't have religion. Just because you're still guilty about masturbating doesn't mean you were traumatized. It means you probably need to get over the damn guilt about masturbating and go have fun, but it doesn't mean you're traumatized. You might have moderate sexual problems. You might have discomfort or panic around some things like me. I really get pissed off when I see those billboards, but I've got it under control. You're safe with me. I won't get mad or anything. You might get an anger response at things like when somebody says, bless you. Those are things that are kind of tripping you. I'm not going to say triggering you, but tripping you. And you can get over those probably without any help. I had a lot of people angry about lost opportunities. I could have gone to, I've had this several times. I could have gone and got a real degree, but instead I went to Liberty University and got a fake degree. I've heard that so many times, or, you know, Bob Jones University or something like that. I'm not going to play this video, but I do have the link to this because Morg really has a good video on religious abuse and how it leads to religious trauma. So just go watch this. It's not that long, 13 minutes long. He makes some, he or she, I don't remember what his pronouns are, but I think she makes excellent points around how and why it happens. So go look at that. And so now let's get into treatment. Treating depression requires a patient able to identify their own self-defeating thinking. Depression is almost, I mean, underline almost always, bound up with distorted thinking. And that thinking may have come from religious training or other things. But anyway, that's where it comes from. Identifying religion as the problem is really difficult because people oftentimes retreat to religion to treat their depression. So you can see it's a negative feedback loop. You can't get out of it. In reality, while religion promises peace and fulfillment, it often creates more of what it caused in the first place, the depression or something like that. So as a therapist, I have to be careful. If somebody's coming to me with depression, I might figure out in the first few sessions that religion has a lot to do with their depression. But I can't come right out and say, well, get rid of your damn religion and you won't be depressed. That probably wouldn't get me what I want or what they want either. So I have to help them. I help them explore what the roots of that might be. And if they can come to the roots, identify it and move on, that may mean they leave religion. It may mean they go to a more liberal religion. You know, it may do something positive, but it's a real difficult thing on the therapist part to help identify what is the root of depression if religion is a part of it. So there's a lot of therapists, as I've said earlier, that are not trained in this. There's a lot of therapists that have supernatural beliefs themselves. They still believe in New Age bullshit. I literally yesterday had an acquaintance of mine right here in town call me up crying, saying, I just learned my fucking therapist, and those were her words, is a fundamentalist Nazarene. I liked her until a couple of weeks ago when I tried to get her to talk about my religion. She's not Nazarene herself. And the therapist simply wouldn't talk about it or said, well, you ought to find a better church. That was the advice that the therapist had. So therapists can be poorly trained in this area. And because they believe in supernatural themselves, may not be able to challenge those things. So I think the language of religious trauma helps us frame the discussion. It helps us identify the specific events, behaviors, and beliefs that cause the trauma. It does not necessarily challenge directly the trauma or the belief. I mean, like I said earlier, you can't challenge these things directly very efficiently. But the notion of religious trauma focuses on the current impact of the beliefs and helps the therapist or the client or you, if you're trying to get through it without any therapeutic help, helps you identify what it was, and maybe you can start working through some of it yourself. Every religion uses these same tactics, so it's not unique to Christianity or Islam or Mormonism. If a good therapist is working properly with you, they'll do a diagnostic interview. They'll identify what some of the issues are. They may hear depression coming from you. They may see generalized anxiety, OCD, panic, PTSD, all of those things can be related to religious trauma. So a good diagnostic interview is going to help you, help the therapist identify those. And then they're going to turn around and look at what you've told them and help you work through it yourself. As a therapist, I've got all sorts of ideas and hunches and things I want to explore with somebody. But I also admit to myself that I'm probably 80% wrong most of the time, because all these are hunches. And the client is the expert on their world and their belief structure. So I have to be very respectful of that while using good techniques to help them ask the right questions. And that's why it's so important, for example, for us to use street epistemology in our volunteers, is because street epistemology helps you ask the questions without insulting people, ask the questions without overtly undermining anything they believe. It's very important, and every therapist uses, any well-trained therapist uses street epistemology on steroids, at a far higher level than our agents will probably use it. Although I've seen some amazing things come from our agents. There's a number of different treatment methods. Obviously, we're not going to learn about treatment here, except to know that there are treatment methods. And the basis for that is cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, exposure therapy, mindfulness training, and EMDR. We actually talked last night at the support group meeting that I briefly attended about mindfulness. And I hope some of those people were there last night or here tonight. But all the things I list here are things that a good therapist would use. Now, they're not using blanket-wise. They'll listen to what you tell them. They'll try to identify what the issues are. And they will match the appropriate treatment to the identified problem or issue. There are some special cases like religious OCD or scrupulosity that we actually hear some, rare, but I'd say on an average once or twice a month, we'll get a chatter in that's, instead of them washing their hands 200 times a day, they have to pray 200 times a day. It's basically the same impulse. It's just expressed differently. And religions love to grab a hold of people who have religious scrupulosity, because these people they're constantly terrorized of doing something wrong as a religious person. So it's easy to keep them infected with a given religion. So my encouragement to you is that this was not for you to diagnose yourself. Please don't go out of here and say, "Daryl diagnosed me." If you think you might experience this, then I would say get on the Secular Therapy Project. Find a good therapist. You don't even have to go to their office these days, because almost all of them are using distance counseling. And last, help us raise awareness. Start using this term, religious trauma syndrome, and telling people about it. Not that you're diagnosing, but when you hear somebody say, "I can't sleep at night for fear of hell," you can say, "Well, you know, Daryl said that was a possible symptom of religious trauma. You might want to go talk to a therapist about that." And I will guarantee that all the therapists we have in our therapist project are friendly to the notion of religious trauma. They may or may not have had specific training in that area, but you don't need specific training in that area. You just need to understand how to treat trauma. Trauma treatment is going to be the same, whether it's religious trauma or PTSD from a war experience. And I don't mean identical, just similar to. Okay, and here's some resources. Amaya and Eric could put some of the resources up. And I just want to really shout out to Dr. Marlene Winnell and her book, Leaving the Fold, and her program, Journey Free, because we refer people to her all the time. And I think we owe Dr. Winnell a real debt of gratitude for her work in this area and for the very coining the term religious trauma syndrome. You and I would not be talking today about this if it wasn't for her. And I really, really appreciate the work that she has done. And we don't have a conference this week. All right. Well, that is it. Oh, unless you want to go read my books, which I will guarantee will help you with your religious trauma, at least a little bit, especially the God Bearers.
You know, we have another 16 hours, Dr. Ray, if you'd like to pull the book out and you can just start reading it.
Well, I think it's only 9 hours of me narrating, but okay, I can do that.
Dr. Ray, thank you so much. This was fantastic. And we had quite a large number of people attend. And I'm looking at the chat in both Discord on the ACA Discord and here in Zoom. And a lot of people can very much identify with what you're talking about. And it's making it, it seems like people are feeling less crazy about themselves and what they have experienced. And you're giving them some validation. So just can't thank you enough for being here with us tonight.
My absolute pleasure. I could talk all day about this.
I second that completely. Thank you so much. I've been monitoring the chats and everyone was just so thankful. So thank you. It was really, really amazing.
Good.
So let's jump to the Q&A. So one recurrent topic in the questions has been, how can I heal? So one person says, for example, it's been almost 10 years for me and I still live like someone's always watching or judging me. Is there a good way to start to deal with it? And then someone else also asked, how can we stop our brain from, you know, having this reaction? So basically, how can people at their homes help themselves?
Right. Well, I'm going to say, I think this is not something you easily help yourself with. I sound like a salesman for therapists. I know that sounds like what I'm doing. I am not a salesman therapist. You wouldn't try to treat a staph infection yourself. It's a pretty serious infection. You'd go to a doctor and you have to get some very specific antibiotics and you'd trust that the doctor knows what the hell they're talking about. Well, this is a mental infection. And if you're experiencing serious and long-term, I mean, 10 years is a long time. That's a significant chunk out of your entire adult life, then you probably need to consider getting somebody who knows what they're doing and work with them. Now, it's not to say there's not a lot of potential for self-help here. I think you can, I've got several books I recommend on mindfulness. Last night, we talked a bit about mindfulness. Our helpline director actually was involved in that a discussion last night. And I think a book on mindfulness would be the first place I'd recommend you go, besides a therapist. There's, if you go on Amazon, look at the top rated mindfulness books. I could give you a name or two, right? But I don't have them in the top of my head. And learn mindfulness. And I'm going to give you a little quick example of what, of why mindfulness works. And that's, would everybody listen to me very carefully? What is your left big toe feeling like right now? So I'm guessing you hadn't thought about your left big toe today or in the last year, maybe, unless it got hit with a hammer or something. So there are things going on in your body and there are things going on in your mind you are absolutely unaware of. Your heart is beating, you're unaware of it, except maybe if you get scared, you'll feel your heart beating. There are thoughts going through your mind all the time that you're absolutely unaware of. You are listening to my voice right now, and at some point in time tonight, your mind wandered. You got tired of hearing my voice, and your mind wandered off to, I want to go to the grocery store and get some ice cream after I finish this talk with Daryl. And what mindfulness does, it helps you bring those kinds of ideas, focus, and mental activities within, I don't like the word control, but it almost like puts them into a way to understand them and herd them, kind of herd them in the right direction. The more you try to slam down on your brain and say, I don't want to think about that fear of hell anymore, I call it the elephant syndrome. You may have heard this. A little experiment here. Again, guys, bear with me. I want you to do exactly what I tell you here. Please pay attention. Do not think of a pink elephant. All right. Now, I told you not to do that, Madeline, and you did it. You did it anyway. Okay. So how many of you, raise your hand, how many of you thought of a pink elephant when I said that? See, most people do. Probably about 80 to 90% of the people will admit to it, and the other 10% are lying. Oh, I mean, they weren't aware of it. So, When you're told not to do something, it's like your brain focuses on that. And religion uses that. It'll say, you know, don't think about sex all the time. Well, what are you going to do if you're a 14-year-old teenager? You're going to think about sex. And what you're told not to do is what your brain will focus on. It's a paradoxical effect there. So what you want to do is learn how to not just automatically respond to those, and mindfulness can help you do that. It's an incredibly good, I also recommend a little book called The Relaxation Response. And it's a little book written by a medical doctor 25, 30 years ago. Excellent book on how to meditate. It's most extremely simple meditation technique that you can imagine. And I doubt if the book's 100 pages long. You'll learn it really quickly, but you have to practice. It's a habit. You have to get in the habit of doing. That's all. What else, Amaya?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that for my fellow insomniacs, mindfulness also works to fall asleep, which
good.
I can't stress enough how much that has helped me personally, and I know so many other people have benefit from it, so try it. So thank you. Someone else asks, what are some resources for helping others deal with the feelings of life having no purpose? So things like nihilism. Do you think, are there any good resources for specifically social workers and therapists who work with clients dealing with this abyss? And do you think there are any considerations which should be made to Indigenous people? So just to say, before you answer, we have a talk in YouTube, in like RFRX, in which we did touch about on this. So whoever asked this question, you may want to go back and search for the one with Daniela Sousa, who spoke about hope. It's not exactly that, but we did touch on it. So yeah, just before you answer, Dr. Ray, I just wanted to make a little note.
I'm not going to answer that question because I think Daniela did a hell of a lot better job than I could. So I'm going to just leave it up to her. I will say, whoever answered that question, go back to RFRX. It's been about a month or so ago that Daniela did that. And it was a great talk. And I learned from it. I learned quite a bit from it. I thought she really put stuff together nicely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So no, I'm not going to answer that question. I'll please.
Yeah, that's all right. That's okay. More views for our YouTube channel, so can't complain. Anyway, have you talked with religious folks about religious trauma and what has been their overall reaction?
Well, let me first of all say I no longer practice therapy. I coach, but I don't really get involved with therapy any longer. Yes, in the past I did and have. Like I said, you cannot approach a religious person directly and say, well, you're a religious trauma and maybe you're a victim of that, because it just doesn't compute in their mind. Just like that therapist I told you that I met a month or so ago, she could not understand how religious trauma didn't make sense to her, and she's a therapist. So I have talked to many religious people over my career. And what I do is I just have to help them identify the sources. And sometime we can get down, and with enough time and some skill, a good therapist can help you kind of drill down, and you'll find out, oh, it was my grandmother constantly berating me for the way I dressed that I still hear in my head. And I have, and then, and only then, I have something to work with. It's like, okay, they've given me something, I can use my tools to help them work with that. And I'll say, well, let's talk more about your grandmother. Let's talk about where the messages she got. And you know, she's been dead for 20 years. So let's talk about what her voice is saying inside your head right now. And let's listen to that voice. One of the problems many people don't understand about the way our brains work is that more you try to resist, the bigger it gets. So I'm going to resist my grandmother's voice, and I'm going to yell and scream at her, and just going to get louder. We'll start treating each other in my head. Well, she's been dead for 20 years. She is not her problem anymore. It was never her problem. It's your problem. So I take that approach with religious people. And, you know, if at the end of a few sessions they realize that, oh, it wasn't just grandma, it was a whole bunch of other people, including the minister, including the youth minister, including the crazy thing we did at church camp or whatever. There's lots of things they can then start discovering. But Amaya, they have to discover it on their own. I cannot discover it for them.
That's fair. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. And then someone else asks if there is any particular religion which has been studied more extensively than another in terms of religious trauma. And then as a follow-up to that question, do you think that the actual process of living a high-cost religion can qualify as a form of religious trauma? So, for example, the process of losing your community, your faith, dependence on a higher power or a meaning of life?
Yeah, well, let me do the second one first, because high-control religions almost by definition are going to cause trauma. I've met very few people that left high-control religions that I didn't think probably had experienced and continued to experience some kind of religious trauma. So that's a pretty simple answer. The answer to the other question was, are there any that are studied? Well, nobody has studied religious trauma systematically yet. It's a new concept. It's less than 10 years old. As we speak, I know of research projects that are getting off the ground that look like they may be studying components of it. It's not a simple subject, and it's kind of complex. So I think in 10 years, we'll have more of those answers. The other thing is that we're getting more and more research. I mean, think about this. In 1920, after World War I, we called it shell shock. And in 1945, after World War II, we called it battle fatigue. You know, even Vietnam, we still weren't calling it PTSD. It's only been in the last 20 years we've really identified what PTSD, and part of the way we know more about it is because we've got tools for looking inside the brain. We have MRIs, we have chemical analysis, we have neurotransmitter analysis. There's lots of things we now can look at and say, a person under high stress seems to have this pattern of neurotransmitters or of adrenal cortical expression or, you know, stuff like that. So that's why we're just now learning about it. And I think as we learn more and more, we're going to start seeing, well, religious trauma and the behavior looks a lot the same. Somebody who experienced non-religious trauma, their behaviors can look a lot like somebody who's experienced religious trauma. So I'm looking at, if you look at the chemicals and the brains and hormones, you're probably going to see great similarities, if not even identical stuff.
Okay. And following up with the research question, are there any statistics about autistic children and religious trauma in terms of like frequency? Do they suffer from religious trauma more? Maybe it hasn't even been studied because it's obviously very under researched, but
yeah. No, it hasn't been studied, but I will say this. I think people who are on the autism spectrum are more susceptible to bad religion. I mean, if you're on the autism spectrum and you're going to an Episcopalian church, I'm not sure the church is going to really bug you, or the Unitarian Church or the United Church of Christ. But if you're in a church like a Baptist, Mormon, you know, some of those churches tend to identify behavior problems as religious in nature, as in you're possessed by a demon. Well, if your church says that you are possessed by a demon and you're on the autism spectrum, that could be incredibly damaging. So in that sense, I think that child is very susceptible to traumatizing experiences. Now, I want to distinguish. There's a difference between a potentially traumatizing experience and a trauma. You know, some people are resilient, some people it doesn't take on. So that same child might not be as devastated by it as another child. And we really don't understand the whole autism spectrum. And it could be the result of many different neurological conditions. But people who are neurologically atypical, I mean, there's lots of sources for that. And we've gotten away from trying to say what's normal and what's not normal. I mean, I used those terms earlier more in terms of the bandwidth of a given hormone or something like that. But in terms of autism spectrum and neurologically atypical people, there's lots of different ways those people can function in society. Religion doesn't acknowledge that. And religion will persecute people and really hurt them for their non-typical behavioral patterns. So the answer is yes. That's a short answer.
Well, I think we have time for one more question. You had talked a little bit about how to kind of recover from this. One of the questions, I'll just read it out. Is there a difference in how you treat religious trauma other than identifying it as the source? And it sounds like you kind of talked about that with both mindfulness and finding someone who is able to treat it, like professional therapist.
Give me that question again. I didn't quite understand the first part.
The question, I think, basically, it seems like the first part of treating religious trauma is actually identifying that it is in your tap-in, that you've got it. And is there anything, the question is, I guess, is there anything additional that can be done to help treat it? And it sounds like you had said some mindfulness and then also finding some professional help.
Well, I think learning meditation techniques, which is different than mindfulness. Mindfulness and meditation overlap significantly, but I think meditation is a really good thing for everybody to learn. I've been meditating since I was 22 years old on a pretty regular basis. Once you get the habit, once you learn how to do it, it's like exercise. You know, I run 3 to 4 miles, 2 to 3 times a week. And I've been doing that since I was 32 years old. Now I'm in the habit. I like doing it. I enjoy it now. I didn't enjoy it when I learned, when I first started. But some habits that are good for you, like exercise, take time. And I think I'm going to recommend two things in answer to that question, Eric. Number one is exercise is good no matter what, for almost any mental condition or mental illness. There's so much research that shows exercise does as much as drugs do. And I'm not dissing drugs. I'm very positive about using drugs for treatment if they're used appropriately. But the best drug you can do is exercise. That's really the best, and it's self-administered. The second thing you can do, and it is also a drug, and that is meditate. Because when you meditate, your brainwaves change and your neurochemicals change. You produce more good chemicals and less bad chemicals, and the stress hormones that you produce throughout the day dissipate. There's a lot of good things that come from that. And the side benefit of learning good meditative skills, and I'm talking 20 minutes a day, once a day, every day of the week, the side benefit is it will help treat any religious trauma as well. It's not the final answer, but it will help you a long way down the road. I'll tell you, if you come into me as a therapist and say, I've been learning meditation, I've been working for the last 6 months on it, I'm getting good at it, and it's helped my anxiety, would you help me? I'm going to say, hell yeah. I'd practically let you pay me because that's the best kind of client, the one that's actually doing shit to help themselves.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. This has been great. Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.